Welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark, and I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg and Peter Suderman. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm swell.
I am so happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-controversies, Comedy Central decided to pull a rerun of an episode of South Park that debuted earlier this year in which Charlie Kirk was parodied. Kirk, of course, was killed in the midst of an appearance on a college campus in precisely the sort of setting he was parodied on the show, which undoubtedly led to some awkward conversations at Comedy Central and Viacom. It should be noted that the episode itself is still streaming on Paramount Plus, while the distributor has occasionally memory-holed some episodes of the show South Park, particularly those related to Islamic terrorism, out of fear that deranged yahoos will go all Charlie Hebdo on the network. That's not the case here. And that strikes me as about the right response. I don't think it's unreasonable to pull an episode from regular rotation after a tragedy like this. One could imagine it being pretty jarring for somebody who didn't know that it was a repeat to, you know, kind of stumble on it and be surprised by it. But it's still available to be seen, and that's how it should be. It should be noted that Kirk himself took the teasing in good humor. He tweeted that it was hilarious. He praised the creators of South Park for watching some of his videos. Everybody seemed to take it in good fun. There has been some weird coverage around the move, though. The Hollywood Reporter recently published a roundup of reactions that was initially headlined, "Some in MAGA blame South Park for Charlie Kirk assassination as Comedy Central pulls episode." This is probably nominally, literally true in the sense that some rando somewhere tweeted about how Comedy Central had Charlie Kirk's blood on their hands or whatever. But virtually every reaction I saw, outside of like a very quickly, or I don't know about quickly deleted, but outside of a tweet from a Turning Point staffer who had said, you know, this is you know, how they think of us, this is how they treat us, blah, blah, or something like that. Was opposed to the move. Like all the conservatives I've seen have been like, Kirk wouldn't have wanted this. He wouldn't have wanted the episode deleted. He would have wanted people to see it. Again, he thought it was funny. Took it in good humor. One last kind of tangent on all this is that I am curious to see how the South Park guys, how Parker and Stone react to what happened this last week. I do not think they will blame themselves. They should not blame themselves. They are not to blame for this. But they are ardent free speech warriors. This is like a thing that they very strongly believe in. And the killing of Kirk and the celebration of his assassination are kind of a blow against the very idea of the free exchange of ideas. You don't get to kill somebody in America because they said something that hurts your feelings or they believe something you believe is abhorrent. That you don't get to do that. I can't help but think that they kind of have to respond to this in some way, given the episode earlier this year. Peter, first things first, what did you make of Paramount Plus's call here?
This seems like a totally reasonable decision. They're not making it impossible to find. You can still watch it if you want. This is not censoring their own product or the what the South Park creators are doing or anything like that. It's just being sensitive to the moment in which you choose to broadcast. And I think that is just for our listeners who maybe don't work in any kind of media, don't work in journalism or Hollywood or anything, if you are working in a field like that at any given time, in journalism in particular, with sort of daily, sort of always on 24/7 publishing, even in a small organization, you have a mix of stuff that is going up. And some of that stuff is produced very quickly to respond to the news of that day or that hour. And some of this stuff is produced much more slowly. I work on at Reason a lot of our long features that often take weeks or even months to produce, and those get scheduled, and they sometimes get scheduled a week or 10 days in advance. And then there are some times when the news happens and it's no longer appropriate for any number of reasons, not necessarily even because of offense or whatever, just no longer appropriate. Oh, this is not what people are going to be talking about right now. Oh, this needs to wait. And this is just a very common kind of decision not to pull coverage because of some sort of, I don't know, crazy conspiracy or because there's it's just, this is how journalism, media scheduling works. And I don't think that there is, if they were like, we're disappearing this episode and pretending it never happened, we're not going to acknowledge it, you can't access it, anything like that, that would be a different story. But what's going on here is not that.
And Peter, I think just to be clear for our listener at home, what you're talking about is sort of analogizing what Comedy Central did to saying like, hey, maybe this lifestyle feature doesn't belong on the top of the homepage of a newspaper at a time when a national tragedy has happened. You're not making the article disappear, correct, but you're saying, you know, this is not the thing that we want to promote most aggressively given this moment.
I know of some very lighthearted features and pieces at publications, multiple publications. This is not necessarily even what I'm talking about, my own organization, that when George Floyd happened and when there were riots, there were just these pieces that had been in the works for a long time and that were understood to be tonally wrong for the moment. And those pieces all did eventually run. It wasn't because they were bad or because the organization was embarrassed by them or anything like that. And this is just it's unfortunate that you have national tragedies that these things happen. It's more than unfortunate. It's horrible. And it's just, but like a very reasonable thing to do. Frankly, just, you can think about this. You can analogize this to going over to a friend's house for dinner. Maybe you were going to talk, like, maybe in some cases you were good, like the subject of conversation was going to be very light and very funny, and you were going to gripe about what's going on with your family or with work or tell us, like, and something happens in your own life or their life, or something happens in your local town or some, right? Like, and like suddenly it's like, we're going to like, not, this is not what we're going to talk about right now. And that doesn't mean you'll never make a joke again.
Yeah. Alyssa, what did you make of
all
this?
I think it's a totally reasonable decision. I think this is a rarer than is normally the case situation in which you actually know that the person who was targeted liked the art in question. That's like a fairly sort of rare thing to be able to point to. But it totally makes sense that you would not want to sort of replay that immediately right now. I wanted to actually take sort of a step backwards though, because there was an interesting sort of meta note to the story that you sent us about this. The Hollywood Reporter was reporting on this decision and kind of linked back to this piece of the New York Post that had some material about how people were reacting to the episode that was subsequently deleted, and the Post hadn't been updated to sort of reflect that some material had been removed. And I think that one thing I've been thinking about a lot in the wake of Kirk's assassination is the sort of instability of the internet and the ways in which it sort of is producing ideas, actions, that kind of defy understanding. And this is also happening at a moment when I think, you know, sort of AI has the potential to make our shared reality just not sustainable, much more fragmentary. And for reporting about this to, you know, sort of end up caught even in a slight way in the sort of weirdness and instability of the internet, I don't even know that saying that it's interesting to me is exactly what I want to say here, but this just seems like a moment where everything is interpretation and nothing is substance, and I'm trying to, I don't know, make sense of that in my own head.
Yeah, there is an interesting kind of meta question about journalistic ethics here, where, long story short, the Hollywood Reporter reported that a conservative radio host, Jesse Kelly, had said that South Park was to blame for this, that, you know, they shouldn't have, whatever, they had blood on their hands or some such. And then linked to a New York Post article. I clicked on the New York Post article because I was like, that doesn't sound like, that doesn't sound like something Jesse Kelly would say, I don't think, but maybe. And there was neither the quote nor he was in it. And then after a little bit of further Further, it was revealed that the Hollywood Reporter had quoted accurately from the New York Post story, which deleted and did not append a correction to it, it's a no-no. You shouldn't do that just because. But for the reasons Alyssa says, like, it's hard enough to know what is actually real and what is not at this moment where you have lifelike AI video doing whatever, you know, to people's brains, where you have court cases being imagined and hallucinated by AI and inserted into legal documents. It is not ideal right now to be playing around with reality in a way that is not easily, rectified, understood, whatever. This is all kind of subsidiary to the other problems we're facing right now.
I take your point, but I really did enjoy your review of The Conjuring.
Peter's joking, but like there is, I was trying this again, meta point here. I was trying to remember if I had written a review of The Conjuring 2. I actually reviewed the first Conjuring. I reviewed the first Conjuring, but I couldn't remember if I had reviewed the second one. And I Googled it, and Google's AI was like, yes, Sonny Bunch has reviewed it. And he said it took religion very seriously, and that's why it was good. And I was like, that doesn't sound like something I would write. Hold on, let me make sure. And sure enough, it wasn't. I didn't review it at all. It was totally hallucinated by the Google chatbot. And the self-immolation of Google is an argument, a discussion for another day. But it's all part of the same thing. And it is, you know, we are entering a very weird and scary post-truth environment, and I'm not looking forward to it. And this is one reason why, frankly, I am to bring it back to the subject at hand. This is one reason why I am glad that Paramount is not memory holing the episode, is not getting rid of it, will not, to the best of my knowledge, edit out those sequences that kind of parody Charlie Kirk's style, his debate me bro style. This doesn't mean we can't have a discussion about, you know, the usefulness of such events. I personally have always thought they are silly and not of, you know, whatever. I don't care for them. I don't think they're good or useful or productive to the discourse, but like, it's just a guy talking at the end of the day. We could, I don't know, use more of that, I guess.
Sorry. Which thing do you think is not ideal specifically?
I think it would not be ideal to delete the episode. That would not be ideal. Because again, it just leads to this question of like, well, what did I see? What do I remember? Where is this? What is this? And I feel like having more situations like that rather than fewer would be bad. That's all.
Strongly agree.
Okay, so what do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-controversy that Comedy Central decided to pull an episode of South Park that mocks Charlie Kirk off repeat rotation for the time being, at least? Maybe forever. I don't know. Maybe it'll just live on streaming from now on. Alyssa?
It's a non-controversy. It's the correct decision, although I would be curious to know what the creators make of it.
Peter?
It's a total non-controversy, though, Alyssa, I'm curious to know what the creators make of it. But I, even more than that, like you, I'm very curious to see how South Park deals with this, because one of the things about that show is that it is created in a super fast turnaround manner that allows them to comment on the news within a week or two of it happening in a way that's very rare for scripted shows.
You can go back. I like their first episode after 9/11, which I think came out like a month after 9/11, maybe less than that, was it's a fascinating cultural document to go back and look at now, because it is it's an controversy. It's totally fine. I remember after 9/11, what was it? I think it was an episode of The Simpsons where the Simpsons go to New York City, was pulled out of syndication for a while. And then I think there was like an edit of that episode where they took out a sequence at the World Trade Center, which
there were a bunch of post 9/11 edits. The two that stick out to me most are they removed a sequence featuring the World Trade Center, the Twin Towers, from the Sam Raimi Spider-Man film that was set to come out the following summer.
Well, I think just from the trailer, I don't think it was actually in the movie.
My understanding is that it was supposed to be in the movie. They stopped airing the trailer, and they did that sequence. Definitely isn't in the film. Maybe I am mistaken that it was never supposed to be in the film, but I believe that sequence was supposed to be in the film and was taken out. Again, it's been 20 years since I looked at the details there. It's possible I'm wrong. But then they also significantly delayed and somewhat re-edited an episode of 24, which I believe was in its first season. It might have been as early as second or third episode in season one. Again, I'm doing this from memory. I could be mistaken a little bit here, but that featured a bomb on a plane. So somebody sets a bomb on a plane and then blows the escape door and parachutes out in the sequence, and they edited it to be sort of less showing you what is happening, though you get a sense of what's going on there. And that sort of thing, that does not strike me as unreasonable at all. I mean, especially these sort of like editing something before it comes out, before anyone has seen it. Though in the case of the Spider-Man movie, you know, people had in fact seen at least the trailer version of the Twin Towers bank heist sequence.
Sex and the City removed the Twin Towers from the credit sequence, which in a way is interesting because it was an acknowledgement that that part of New York was no longer there. I don't believe that they removed it from the episodes that aired before the attacks.
Yeah. I mean, this is one thing I always I had thought about bringing this up in our discussion of caught stealing the other day, but Aronofsky very explicitly has like the Twin Towers in multiple shots, just like as background, you know, material, in part to help you kind of understand when it is and the time frame and stuff.
Well, but, you know. And then fascinatingly, in Highest to Lowest afterwards, they're the one World Trade Center that has been put in, you know, that has come up since, plays a pretty significant background kind of symbolic role in quite a few of, in several, I should say, of the scenes in that movie.
Make sure to swing by Thursday, swing by Bulwark Plus on Thursday for a bonus episode of this program on Stephen King's cinematic adaptations. There's been 76 of them, maybe more. I don't know. I don't know. I can't speak to the accuracy of Wikipedia, but there's a lot. Speaking of which, on to the main event, The Long Walk, based on a novella by Richard Bachman, about whom I have learned, by the way, that people get very mad if you don't immediately say Richard Bachman is a pseudonym for Stephen King. This has happened on multiple pieces of mine recently. I have taken to just leaving Richard Bachman there by himself in an effort to annoy these people, because it's like it's the one pseudonym that every modern person knows who is a reader, and they're like, well, what about my trivia? Remind people about the trivia I know. Anyway, the Long Walk setup is pretty simple. 50 young men living in a post-economic crash United States, one from each state, are chosen to compete in a Hunger Games-style ultra marathon. They start walking. If they drop below 3 miles per hour on this walk, they are given a warning and 10 seconds to get back up to speed. 3 warnings, and you get executed. Last man standing receives a wish. A wish. There's a genie granting wishes and unimaginable wealth. Cooper Hoffman stars as Ray Garrity, who quickly forms a bond with fellow walker Peter McVries, who's played by David Johnson, alongside the fellow four musketeers of Arthur Baker, who's played by Tut Nyot, and Hank Olsen, who's played by Ben Wang. They are antagonized by the sociopathic Barkovich, played by Charlie Plummer, as well as the looming specter of death that is also tormenting and antagonizing them. Also, there's the bombastic Major, who's played with hammy glee by Mark Hamill, who spends most of the movie shouting about the big balls these kids have and how their gory sacrifice will inspire the nation to marginally increase the wilting American gross domestic product. I have two competing thoughts about The Long Walk. I came out of the movie theater with two competing thoughts about The Long Walk. The first is that it's a very compelling, it's reliably cinematic, despite being a story about guys walking and talking for an entire movie. Yes, the stakes being literal life and death make it all a bit more dramatic, just inherently, but each of these characters is sketched out in a way that immediately makes them feel lived in without quite being cardboard cutouts, right? It's less of a Hunger Games and more like a war movie, right? More like a Saving Private Ryan or a Band of Brothers. There's a fraternal camaraderie here that calls to mind another King adaptation, that of The Shawshank Redemption. The colors are appropriately washed out and bleak. The violence is jarringly brutal. There are no quick cutaways here, no obscuring the violence at the heart of the titular contest. When the first teenager dies just a few miles into the walk, suffering from cramps, we see him get his face blown off in very much close up. The bullet just tearing his head right in half. And we see stuff like this over and over and over again. No flinching. Which brings me to my second point. And this is more of a personal reaction to the film. You know, as Robert Warshaw once put it, a man watches a movie and the critic must acknowledge he is that man. And I'm sitting there on that Thursday night watching it at like 9:45 p.m. with a full paying, like full audience in my theater, which I was kind of surprised by.
Yeah, I had
and
the
this
same.
Is like. This is like 30 hours or so after, you know, Charlie Kirk was killed, and we had immediately gotten video clips of the moment he was hit and spent a full day not only seeing I spent a lot of the day on social media being annoyed by people because they were either actively cheering it or kind of downplaying it. Like, well, he's a bad guy. He said bad things. What can you expect? In both public feeds and private communications. And that put me in a weird mental space because I know the movie of this purpose, the movie's purpose is not to titillate or celebrate the violence against these young men on the screen. We are supposed to see it as a horrifying example of militarism and national bloodlust, right? The King wrote this around the time of Vietnam. The draft was going on. It's not surprising that this was his headspace as he was writing it. But there is something almost smug and self-satisfied about the repeated imagery of kids getting blown away by the guns in The Long Walk. This kind of self-congratulatory backpatting about how the filmmakers are brave for refusing to flinch from the ugliness. They're not giving the audience a way out. And maybe it's just not fair to the movie. Again, maybe this is just me where I'm watching it at this point. But I do not trust the response of lots of people watching this movie and reacting to it, taking the end of the film in particular at face value. We can get into that. I don't want to spoil the end right away. We can talk about that in a little bit, maybe. But I don't know, man. I have come to doubt that people are actually all that opposed to rhetorical or literal violence at heart. They sit there and they think, well, what we are watching is cruel and bad and evil, but I am not cruel and bad and evil. It's that guy over there. We just get rid of those guys over there and we'll all be fine. World will be a better place. And I don't think people really think about what that getting rid of means or entails or want to wrestle with it. I don't know. Again, we can discuss the end of the movie in a minute here, because that is like almost literally the end, the point of the end. But I came out of that movie theater thinking, we are screwed. We're in a bad place and it's not going to get better. Alyssa, I got the sense that from your reaction to the film that you were a little bit surprised by the level of violence as well. It was not quite to your liking.
So it's not just the violence. And I want to back up for a second. I did not know Charlie Kirk personally. I did not agree with the vast majority of what he said. But he and I have a mutual friend, and this mutual friend found out that he was dead when her social media feed served her a video of him getting shot in the neck. And, you know, I think there are some things that it is just, like, it's not good to have seen. I have not watched that video very consciously. I do not want to see it. And I think the fact that all of this was unfolding as I saw The Long Walk on Friday really colored my reaction to that movie. I was very, very disturbed by this. And I've talked a lot on this podcast about how sort of my tolerance for certain kinds of violence and horror and gore have increased over time. But a lot of the images in this movie have sort of worm their way into my brain in a way that does not feel illuminating or clarifying or sort of, you know, inspiring in the sense that I feel moved to act against it, I feel sort of degraded by having watched this movie. And it's not just the images of people being shot in the face. It's the images of people, you know, shitting their guts out on a road and then being shot in the face. It's the image of someone stabbing a blunt spoon into his own neck. It's the image of someone having walked miles on a destroyed ankle. It's the image of someone, you know, sort of going insane and stripping naked and being shot to death. There is a moment in the movie where, you know, when Art has had sort of internal hemorrhage, he knows he's going to die. He sort of says goodbye to his friends. And the last promise that he exacts from them is that they not look. And I find it really hard to reconcile the movie we watched with that idea, right? That, I do think that there are cases where witnessing something on film or in a photo can be genuinely radicalizing, right? Like, I've interviewed Nick Utt, the Associated Press photographer who took a picture of Kim Phuc after she was burned by napalm in Vietnam, right? And like, I think people should look at that picture because it is a reminder of what war does to human beings, that kids are not immune from it. It is a real thing that happened. It's incredibly vulnerable, and in some ways, you know, it is an image of a person who has been degraded by something that the U.S. military did. But I think there are some things that it's not good to look at precisely because they become abstractions, right? And for my friend, you know, a video of her friend getting shot in the neck and dying in front of a lot of people was not an abstraction. But I think putting that image on repeat sort of is an abstraction. And I don't feel like I know more about this fictional society or the nature of violence by an hour and a half of watching people be destroyed. And I get this is not a commentary on the quality of the movie. In fact, I think it's quite well made in a lot of ways. I think Cooper Hoffman, like, that kid has the stuff, maybe not the way that his father did, but he's a good actor. He really holds the screen in sort of a difficult challenge for a long time. I think that there's a lot of good dialogue writing in this movie, but watching it, I had these two disparate senses of how it could be received. I could see this becoming a sort of classic movie of male camaraderie, right? But I could also see it stripped down and reduced to just gore and degradation videos that people trade on Discord. And the fact that I don't know which way it will go, I don't know that it speaks to sort of a failure of the art, but I do kind of think that it speaks to a failure of us. And I don't think this is this movie's fault. You know, I don't think this movie is made with sort of ill moral intent. I think it's made with artistry and skill, but I just feel like I should not have watched it. I don't feel good about having watched it. And I don't know what to do with that.
Yeah, I mean, I know precisely how it will end up being used, which is, as you say, in gif-able snippets that are like, hey, here's what I'm going to do to you on all over the internet. It's not the movie's fault. It's not the movie's fault. And this is the thing. This was the hard thing I was wrestling with after the movie. You know, I'm on Rotten Tomatoes, so I have to kind of make a decision on whether I give something a thumbs up or thumbs down. And I have to give it a thumbs up just because it is very well made. But at the same time, I don't even think it reflects. Peter, what did you make of The Long Walk?
It's a pretty good movie. It's hard to watch the day after Charlie Kirk is shot. I managed to avoid the Charlie Kirk video, but of course that was what I was thinking about while watching the movie. It's not the movie's fault that there are parallels here, that it had the kind of misfortune, I guess, or sort of the weird timing, whatever you want to call it, to come out the day after Charlie Kirk was murdered. I guess independent of that, the thing that surprised me most about this movie was just how much of an unreconstructed Vietnam metaphor it is. And the way that that was not heavily updated for a modern audience. I mean, you can, there were some changes made to the ending in particular, but this movie read visually and as a story like something that was written when Vietnam was fresh on the minds of young men and society. And the J.T. Molnar and Francis Lawrence, screenwriter and director, did not really make a big effort to change that and make it much more contemporary in a way that I thought was kind of interesting. Because you can totally imagine a much more contemporary version of this movie. And in fact, I think some critics were trying to make it that. I certainly read at least one review that said, oh, this is a movie where it's easy to see it as a metaphor for the burdens of capitalism, which is okay. I won't dispute that you can make that reading. It's a pretty weird reading for a movie that's basically about an authoritarian state that and where this, like, you literally are pledging fealty to a state for like trying to defy its censorship regime, or not you, but one of the characters' family members, where the whole thing is that this is the government doing it for you, and we're doing it to these kids, and where it's very obvious, like I said, that the closest real world analog is the draft in Vietnam, which was not capitalism, right? Which was not, you know, this is a private market force. This is not, you know, the Great Recession's aftermath.
Let me just interrupt here for a second, because there is that whole, there's a whole speech in the whole discussion in the middle, I don't know, first third or so of the movie, where Cooper Hoffman's character is talking about, Ray Garrity's talking about how, you know, nobody actually has a choice here. We all sign up for this lottery because it's the only, that's only because it's the only way out of this mess we all find ourselves in. This is, you know, and that I think would be the idea of the capitalism metaphor here.
There are two spots that if I wanted to make, like I said, I can see how you can get there with a reading. I don't think it's completely insane. It just doesn't seem like the most obvious reading or anywhere close. There are basically two spots where if you want to do a reading that says this is a movie about capitalism, you have to go, and it's that conversation about whether there's really any choice to participate. I mean, this is a kind of fairly common argument made on the left about the deprivations of capitalism, is that people say it's voluntary, it's a choice. It's not, right? Which I disagree with, but that's a different conversation. And then that bit at the beginning where the major is talking about how we're going to do this to motivate people to increase GDP, right? That is a sort of economic argument. But, you know, there's a whole big sequence in the middle of this where they all walk up a hill. And at this point, most of the boys are still alive. But during this night walk up a hill, a very large percentage of them, the boys whose names we mostly don't know, who are the kind of the background characters, you know, not the focus characters, a large percentage of them die. And that is very clearly a pretty straightforward kind of transference metaphor for the, you know, the sort of forced marches, the attacks uphill that happened in Vietnam. Like that is just directly pulled from a kind of Vietnam-like experience. And then you see the kinds of clothes these guys are wearing. They're not wearing Nikes and sort of, you know, like correct running shoes. I mean, if you had this in like, there's a very 2025 version of this movie in which you have like elite kids training, right? And showing up in their like Lululemons or whatever. I don't know what they
get, right? Like they're wearing, right? You've got the like spray on Nike, one use Nike custom shoes, or like it's very much like the Hunger Games, like the people who have been training to be tributes. Yeah.
But and even this movie doesn't go there at all. Like it just absolutely refuses to do any of that very direct contemporary stuff. And it's just interesting that they wanted this to feel, that they allowed this to remain such a clear Vietnam metaphor and so rooted in that era.
I don't know. I feel like I'm, you know, It's a hard movie to talk about just because it succeeds at doing what it's trying to do. I'll put it that way. It succeeds at doing what it's trying to do, I think, which is be a kind of horrible metaphor for life and, you know, the dreadful experience of existing in a system designed to grind you down, right? Okay, sure, fine. It succeeds at that.
Can we talk about the end?
Sure, let's talk about the end.
Because, you know, sort of one of the... throughout the movie, we learn that Ray's father was executed by the Major for subversion, and that his plan, if he wins, is to request one of the guns that the guards has been holding and to shoot the Major in an effort to sort of upend the system. And when he decides to drop out of the race, he does so in part because he believes that Pete, who has endured this horrible childhood, but and sort of has kept himself like alive through the power of positive thinking, will have sort of a more positive vision of what to do. And instead, Pete carries out Ray's vision, shoots the Major, and then walks away on a sort of seemingly empty street. And it's not totally clear whether he is actually just sort of leaving and continuing to walk or whether he's been killed by the Major's guards. I think either interpretation is possible. But it is interesting to me that both this and the Hunger Games books and movies, which were wildly popular, end with shooting someone you perceive as a threat to sort of someone who you perceive as an authoritarian threat and who, you know, with good reason, right? I mean, these are people who are not guilty of speech acts. They are, you know, Major has murdered, you know, probably hundreds of boys over the course that this has been happening. He delivers the final coup de grace at the end of each competition. And in the Hunger Games, Katniss Everdeen kills not the sort of dictatorial president of the Capitol, but the president of District 13, who has been sort of leading the rebellion against the Capitol, because it turns out she is sort of as bad and as dictatorial and as violent as the Capitol is. And presidents know that, sort of like incidentally, like chokes to death in his own blood. And again, you know, I think part of my reaction to this movie is like, it's a movie that suggests, you know, that could be read as, and I don't think it necessarily is saying this, but it could be read as saying that like the only thing to do in a scenario where you are under authoritarian government is to shoot somebody. And I think that the movie is actually saying something different. It's saying that Pete has been so sort of degraded by this experience that he is not able to sort of pursue Ray's vision of him. I don't know. I'm not entirely sure about that interpretation, but it is interesting that Francis Lawrence has directed this and part of another franchise that sort of leads to some of the same, leads to this same final spectacle, if not the same conclusion.
My read on the end, again, in which the winner shoots the Major in the hopes of making things better, is that is actually the message here, is that if you things are bad and the only way to get better is to get rid of the tormenting figure, that guy, again, it's that guy over there, get rid of that guy over there, things will be better. And I don't know, man, this is a movie where you see all of the society kind of lining up on the streets to watch these kids die, and I'm like, I don't, that does not, maybe that's how you make it better, but seems like there's some fairly pervasive rot.
Well, the Stephen King story, the Richard Bachman story, sorry, Richard Bachman book, is much more directly nihilistic. And this movie, I think understandably, given that it's aimed at something like a mass audience, this is not, you know, a little tiny indie film that is only trying to appeal to a very small group of people. This movie tries to leaven that nihilism at the end with something like a sort of hope in, you know, the bonds of manhood and togetherness or something. And I wouldn't say that it's entirely hopeful or it, like that it's a happy ending in a straightforward way. That's not what I'm trying to argue. but it tries to leaven the, or mitigate some of the original story's fairly straightforward nihilistic hopelessness. And it's a tough balance to strike.
All right. Depressing episode. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on The Long Walk, Alyssa?
I really want to be clear that, like, I think this movie is well made, but I can't recommend it. And giving it a thumbs down is not a reflection on its quality. I just am not sure. I cannot recommend it, even though I think it's well made.
Peter?
I give it a thumbs up.
Yeah, I ended up going thumbs up because it is just it's a well-made movie. It's pretty gripping. It is heartrending, et cetera. Great performances. It's well shot. But it leaves me feeling very bad about America in ways that I do not think the movie entirely intended. So I don't know. All right. That is it for today's show. Many thanks to our producer, Dante DeChico. Tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SonnyBunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.